Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. Putting a biography together is an arduous process. It requires countless hours chasing down primary documents, tracing the footsteps of one's subject in far-flung places, and zigzagging the world in search of a clue. Librarians and archivists are essential partners in the onerous business of research and can make or break your project. Bio certainly understands this. It's why we created the Biblio Award, which recognizes a librarian or archivist who has made an exceptional contribution to the craft of biography. As you will hear, today's episode is in two parts. In February 2025, I met up with Bio's Vice President, Heather Clark, at New York Public Library's Cullman Center, where she's a fellow. Dr. Clark is the chair of Bio's 2025 Awards Committee. Her book, Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath, was a Pulitzer finalist. I asked Heather to share with our listeners the award committee's nomination and selection process. So, Heather Clark, congratulations on your Cullman Fellowship, and thank you for meeting with me today. What are the awards that Bio provides?
I'm the chair of the awards committee, and my committee is responsible for three major awards. The first is the Bio Award, which is the highest honor Bio presents to an individual for contributions to advancing the art and craft of biography. So each winner of the Bio Award is presented with a bronze plaque and a cash prize at Bio's annual conference, which usually happens in May or June. That's our biggest award. We also offer the Editorial Excellence Award, and that is presented to an outstanding editor from nominations submitted by Bio members and Bio Board of Directors. And lastly, the Biblio Award, and that is presented to an outstanding librarian or archivist. And again, awardees are selected from nominations given by Bio members and the Bio Board of Directors. So basically, if you're a Bio member, you can nominate anyone you want for any of these three awards. And in fact, we love nominations, right? The more, the better.
So if I wanted to nominate somebody for an award, who do I contact and what's the process?
You would contact this year, me, because I'm the chair of the awards committee. Now that might change, you know, from year to year. My committee members are Tim Duggan, Alalia Bundles, Jack Farrell, and Will Swift. And so you could contact any of us and just say, I would like to nominate so-and-so for such and such award. And, you know, we keep a list and we go through all the names at our committee meetings. We talk about everyone who is nominated. We take all nominations seriously.
So as the chair of the awards committee, how long is your process? Does it take a full year? And how often do you guys meet?
We meet throughout the year. The first award we meet about is the Editorial Excellence Award, because we usually have a reception in the fall for the awardee. So we start meeting about the Editorial Excellence Award in the summer and solicit nominations. We have some meetings about that. And then the next one is the Bio Award. Usually that's announced in February. We usually have the most meetings about the Bio Award just because it's, you know, it's our most prestigious. And then the last one we meet about is the Biblio Award, and that is also presented at the annual conference. So we'll start actually meeting about the Biblio Award soon, and we're looking for nominations. So if you have a librarian or an archivist who has helped you write a biography, you know, let us know. We want to know. If you've written a biography, you know how important a good archivist can be, right? That person can tell you about things that maybe they're not in the finding aid, maybe they just came in, maybe they're still being processed. A good archivist can really help you in your project. So we're looking for those kinds of people who understand what it takes to write a biography and who sort of help you rather than make things more difficult, because sometimes that happens too in an archive. So we just want to give a special shout out to those archivists who help us as biographers, help us with our task and make it easier. And it's also recognition that we couldn't write these books without the help of archivists. So it's sort of a way of recognizing, that role, the importance of that role, and giving back a bit. So when we present that award at our annual conference in June.
That was Heather Clark talking with me at the Kullman Center in early February 2025 about her role as 2025 Awards Committee Chair. Last year's Biblio Award winner was Steve Ennis, director at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas. Dr. Ennis certainly understands a biographer's journey, having written After the Titanic, The Life of Derek Mahone. I spoke with Steve via Zoom in February 2025 and began my conversation by asking about his journey into the archives.
I did my undergraduate studies in English at Davidson College in North Carolina and have a literary background. But when I was finishing my degree in the early 1980s, I was, by a mentor, I was encouraged to think about getting a degree in library science, which I did immediately upon graduation. But finishing that library degree, I really wanted the disciplinary grounding in English and in literature that the library degree did not offer me. So I immediately enrolled in a PhD program in English at the University of Georgia. That's opposite from how many people enter the library and archive field. That is, it's more typical for someone to receive their advanced subject degree and then get a professional degree. And I did those things in reverse order. But in hindsight, one of the great benefits of that was when I was finishing my graduate work, I was already known in the library community. And so unlike all of my fellow graduate students who were entering, those terrible days of job hunting, I simply received my degree and went back to Emory, where I'd gotten my library degree. And so it became a very fortunate kind of path for me. I spent 16 years at Emory University building literary collections. That was a time of great growth at Emory, and we acquired the papers of numerous figures, including the late poet laureate of England, Ted Hughes, and the archive of Salman Rushdie, and many, many other figures. And so I had about every job one can have at Emory, and ultimately had the opportunity to move to the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., which was an extraordinary experience and grounded me in a very robust and rich research environment in an institution with a national and international reach. And I worked with some very talented curators during those years and learned a great deal about the whole ecosystem for the research library community. And on the strength of that work in Washington, I had the opportunity to come here to the Ransom Center.
So as a new biographer, when I visit the Harry Ransom Center, what are some things that I should keep in mind as a first-time visitor to the center?
First thing I would say is the Ransom Center in the field of literature is really one of the country's finest literary archives. And so there's a wealth of material here, and advanced preparation for any research trip is always, useful time well spent. We have some gifted curators here that are happy to respond to email queries about the area of your research. What future researchers might benefit from knowing is that when we're building collections, we're not simply acquiring the one-off archive by itself, but we're really looking for relationships between archives. So often what happens is a researcher arrives thinking they're looking at one collection, but then discovering that the tentacles reach outward into numerous collections. And so understanding that in advance of a research visit and having an opportunity to research, if you're focused on a single figure, where they might appear in other collections, it would be very useful. We sometimes speak of the collections here as having a kind of creative DNA, linking them to one another, and teasing out those connections makes it a rich research environment, and advanced preparation on all of that would be time well spent.
So that kind of answers my next question, but maybe you have some further things to say on how can an archivist help a biographer with their work?
Yes, I partly answered it, and in terms of we've got embedded here subject experts that know these collections very, very well, and they can be very useful guides to the collections. The Ransom Center also provides generous fellowship funding for researchers on a competitive basis, so there may even be fellowship funds to support individuals' research. We're reviewing this year's round of fellowship proposals now. And our curators can help guide you through all of those, whether they're research-oriented questions or funding-based questions, can guide you through that process. I will say, to answer your question in another way, some of the most fruitful archives, in my experience, have been recently acquired collections. And because of the fact that we collect living figures, dealings with estates can be sometimes a challenge and even problematic. I think back about some of the biographers that I've had the pleasure of working with most closely, and some of those have been, challenging situations. And there can be benefits to even consulting librarians, and archivists, curators on some of those challenging questions around rights issues and even sensibilities and feelings that the creative figure, him or herself, or their estates may have about uses of different kinds. I should quickly add, the goal is never to censor the work of the biographer, but we sometimes have, some insight into, who the biographer may feel they'll be dealing with at some point in the future, and can be helpful in that way too.
Well, you're a biographer yourself. How has your experience doing research in other archives shaped your work at the Harry Ransom Center?
Yeah, I spent a number of years working on a biography of the contemporary Irish poet Derrick Mann. I did so really as a labor of love, just get great satisfaction, as I know many of you do, in working with primary source documents. And there's something just rich about having the time to delve into an archive and piece together the story of a life that may otherwise not be familiar or known. I think it, from my point of view, it's very important that those people who run our research institutions, that they know what research is. And that's not always the case, I'm afraid to say. And so it's not always the case that the director of an institution like mine will be a researcher, but I think there's enormous benefit institutionally and for the whole success of the enterprise if there's an understanding of what research actually entails. In my own research in institutions around the US and in the UK and in Ireland, I've encountered very, very supportive colleagues and archivists and librarians. And I've also encountered some rather entrenched and antiquated ways of doing things. And so that direct experience of what's happening on the ground in peer institutions around the country or around the world helps inform how I hope we might do things better here.
The Harry Ransom Center has the papers of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Kazuo Ishiguro, and recently Lorne Michaels. What is the process of acquiring these archival documents?
That's a big question. Everyone is unique. I mean, every acquisition is unique. That's because in most of the examples you just cited, we were dealing with or are dealing with living figures, some of them still very active in the prime of their lives. Only the Garcia Marquez collection came to us from his estate. You're trying to understand what the creator's own goals are for the collection. Some of the figures I've worked with in the past, when we've initiated contact about would they be interested in placing their archive with us, insist that, I don't have an archive. But of course, everybody has accumulated a documentary record about their life's work. And so we often find ourselves at the beginning trying to establish what an archive is. This was most notable recently when we approached the British novelist Rachel Cusk about her papers, and she was happy to speak with us, but was, dismissive of what she had retained and said, "I really don't have a much of an archive." And in a note that she wrote when we did acquire the papers that she did have, she attributed its thinness to what she described as the weather of domestic life, how that had interfered with her being able to amass something as ominous or big sounding as an archive. But basically, how it always begins is, trying to understand what the individual's goals may be. Two of the examples you cited, Garcia Marquez, his family, and the Lorne Michaels collection, which came to us very recently, we were the beneficiaries of them simply reaching out to us, asking if the Ransom Center would be interested in acquiring those papers. People sometimes imagine, because Garcia Marquez was born in Colombia and spent most of his life in Mexico, that we must have been working under cover of darkness and somehow, ferreting things out of the country in a secretive way. In fact, I was simply sitting at this desk and my phone over here rings, and the question is, would the Ransom Center be interested in acquiring the archive of Gabriel Garcia Marquez? So at that particular moment, there's only one right answer, and the answer is, of course, yes, we would be. And my job then became making that happen. That collection was a purchase, and some people assume that we simply outbid other institutions, but that's not accurate. While we do purchase collections, I think it's safe to say anyone offered the archive of the Nobel laureate Garcia Marquez would have done what they could to purchase that collection. Really, the only question was, who was the family going to offer it to? And we were delighted to have been chosen and offered that collection first. So the negotiation was entirely exclusive, just as I say, trying to understand what, in this case, the family's desires were. And similarly, Lorne Michaels very generously contacted us and donated, as a gift, a very generous gift, the archive of the 50-year production history of Saturday Night Live, which has only just now come to us. So sometimes things come as gifts. Sometimes we are able to purchase them. But always the common denominator is trying to understand what the individual's goals are. And it's all, of course, intertwined with notions of permanence and of something that might be lasting. And there are very few positions or institutions that can offer, in this case, a creative figure, some glimpse of what a posthumous life might be like. And we can do that.
How do you deal with digital rot, the lack of a paper trail, the modernization of communications, social media, and that sort of thing?
Virtually every archive we acquire now is a hybrid archive of both paper-based materials and also digital files. And we're really agnostic on what form the archive may come to us in. What we're interested in is the research value of these collections. And so, yes, there's something wonderful working with primary source documents. There are also some frustrations working with primary source documents. But the digital archive also has its rewards. One of the most obvious is when you approach a paper-based archive and say you're interested in the correspondence of a certain figure. Quite often, the letters written by an individual are nowhere to be found in his or her archive, that those are the things that went out into the world. And, we spend years trying to add to an archive to recapture some of that outwardly dispersed and distributed paper trail. But in the digital realm, when we're able to capture email files, either from someone's personal computer or from the cloud, wherever it may be residing, What we find there is that we're capturing both the outgoing and the incoming, and we're also capturing something in a more complete way. Often, what survives in a paper-based archive is what someone deemed was important. And the computer, of course, is totally agnostic on such questions. Everything is there. It's either there or not there. And if it's there, it's both sides of that correspondence. And it's the casual throwaway kind of conversational email, a sentence or two, or it's the thoughtful multiple page kind of document. They're all there. That can be a very rich environment too. In terms of the kind of preservation challenges this material poses, yes, they are significant. We're fortunate to have a very gifted digital archivist whose job is entirely, the preservation of these very ephemeral and fugitive digital files. I look forward in the coming years to seeing some of the recently acquired digital material get as full use as our legacy collections get now, but I think it certainly will happen.
In your opinion, what are some of the hidden gems or undiscovered papers that at the Harry Ransom Center that you feel are underappreciated or somebody has not discovered yet that maybe I could discover?
It's remarkable the number of times a researcher, and I'm not talking now just about the Ransom Center, this could be at Yale's Beinecke or Harvard's Houghton or anywhere. Oftentimes a researcher will arrive and find something that they recognize the importance of. And we may even on occasion even read the news story about a new discovery. More often than not, that discovery, has been known to catalogers and to librarians and archivists. It's been sitting in plain sight. And what we're waiting on is for the researcher's interest and the material archive to align with and stimulate and enable pathbreaking new scholarship. And so that's an exciting moment. It can happen literally across all of our collections. I would push back against the notion that our collections are hidden. They're not hidden. We're proud of our record of cataloging these materials, but often the newly arrived collections, have not yet received the full processing time and attention they require. And so there's always great potential in things that have recently come in. And I'll just cite one example. We recently acquired the 20-year correspondence of the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, W.S. Merwin, the letters that he wrote from 1950 to 1970 to his second wife, Dido Merwin. So no one has read these letters yet. They're not actually open yet, but they will be soon. One of the things that's just very gratifying from my point of view as director of the institution is being a witness to see the early research use that's made of a collection like that one. I think back to when we opened at the Garcia Marquez papers, and one of our very first fellows to come in and use that collection was someone named Alvaro Santana Acuna. We were learning along with him what that collection contained. Yes, we'd cataloged it, but he brought a real specialist eye to the archive that really allowed stories to come out of that collection beyond what we could expose as catalogers and as curators. And so ultimately, we invited him to curate a major exhibition drawn from that archive. And we're now traveling that exhibition to Bogota, Colombia. And Alvaro will be seeing it come to life, not only here in Austin, but also now in Bogota. So lots of discoveries. It's really limitless. Any of these collections, even ones that one might think have been fully mined and looked over, I'm confident there are things lying latent that they can still answer, questions that they can answer that they've not yet been queried about in the past.
I like this symbiosis between the researcher and the archive itself. Speaking of all that, You were the 2024 recipient of the Biblio Award by BIO. This is given to a librarian or an archivist who has made an exceptional contribution to the craft of biography. And I wonder what that has meant to you to have received that award and what it was like to be at the conference.
Yeah, well, first I just want to thank the society for that recognition. People in my line of work, we are committed to service. We want to see culture thrive and literature thrive. We're fellow travelers in that way with those of you writing biographies. More typically, the kind of acknowledgement that my colleagues and I might sometimes receive is a mention and an acknowledgments page, and that's always appreciated and welcome. But in my experience, it's unusual for there to be such an award, and it's very gratifying to know that that the community of biographers is acknowledging the role that librarians and archivists and those of us in the research library field play and their own in advancing their own careers and this new scholarship. So I was delighted, and it was great fun to be there in New York and be present to receive the award. So my thanks to everyone who made that possible.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for your interest.
That was 2024 Biblio Award winner Steve Ennis talking to me about his invaluable work as director at the Harry Ransom Center. Has your work been boosted by an outstanding librarian or archivist? We'd love to hear about it. Head on over to our website, biographersinternational.org, and click on the Contact tab. I'm bio member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Our executive producer is Sonia Williams. Darren Nesblitt created our theme music. Thank you for listening.